Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we discuss mood disorders. According to the National Institute on Mental Health, 9.5% of adults in the U.S. experience a mood disorder each year, and 45% of those individuals will experience severe symptoms of the disorder. Joining us to talk about that is Ann Gagan, social worker and psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and Mark Whaley. Good morning to you all.
Good morning, Mindy.
Good morning.
So let's start with, I guess, what a mood is.
Yeah. This is something that we work with in psychiatry, and we sort of take for granted that we all understand what a mood is. But in more recent years, I've come to understand it based on evolution. And to me, evolution is a gift that keeps on giving. It's rich in the way of explaining what goes on. So just in terms of perspective, the Big Bang that created our universe was about 14 plus billion years ago. About 8 billion years ago, the rock that we live on came into existence.
Give or take a billion.
About 4 billion years after that, or 4.5 billion years from now, life appeared on the Earth for the first time. Something about chemistry, and this is the magic. Maybe religion has an explanation here, but who knows? Something about chemistry led to molecules that like to replicate themselves, and that's life. So life began in the oceans with single-celled organisms. And life had a thing about it that it liked to survive. It wanted to continue, wanted to replicate, wanted to keep on going. That's the magic of the chemistry. Maybe that's the spark of God going to the hand of man. Who knows? Mm-hmm. So in order to stay alive, there had to be some mechanism within the cell, single-cell organisms, to signal when something isn't right in the environment. Maybe it's the temperature. Maybe it's the flow of the fluid. Maybe it's the lack of nutrients, even inside the cell. Maybe it's the pH that is out of whack. So there has to be a signaling system, and there was. We don't fully understand what it was, but there was a signaling system. Well, if we fast, and what it would signal is something is out of balance. We call it in biology homeostasis. Something has thrown the balance of life off and threatens survival. So fast forward to humanity walking on the Earth. We also have a signaling system when something is amiss or seems to be amiss. And the signal could come from inside our body or outside in the environment. But it is a signal that gets our attention to do something to make it right again. And that is really what feelings are. Obviously, the single cell organism didn't consciously experience something's wrong. But humans have the nervous system and the hardware to experience and consciously be aware that something is wrong. And that something is a feeling. So feelings get our attentions pretty quick. They motivate us to a behavior and to try to make things right and even again, to kind of restore homeostasis. And that's really what feelings are. I came into the field thinking, feeling that I knew what a feeling was, but it really goes back to basic life. Mm. It's just a signal. So
is a mood then like an emotion?
Yes.
Okay.
A feeling is an instantaneous thing. So is an emotion. We think of it as more of an instantaneous thing. Something happens, there's a feeling or an emotional reaction. However, if it goes over time, then we have the concept of mood. Mm-hmm. Mood is sort of a given emotional state. It's not an emotion itself, but it's an emotional state. It's a state that lasts over time. One way of calling it is you can think of it as a feeling with legs.
Yeah.
It continues. Yeah. Going further, even longer, moods blend into temperament and personality, characteristics, traits. That's even longer. Think of a mood as an emotional state of being that we are aware of, but it's based on a feeling concept that signals that something is either wrong or something is very good. It doesn't matter. If it's very good, then that signals us to repeat the behaviors to achieve it again or right. keep it. That's basically, I think, the best way to understand what a mood is. We're going to talk about mood disorders.
I was going to say, yeah. What's the mood disorder? I mean, what are mood disorders? There are many, right?
There are many. And the best way to conceive of that in general is that a mood becomes a disorder when it interferes with functioning, when it causes some disruption in the flow of life, in the achievements of the person's goals, when something is stymied, and or when something goes very well, so that you keep repeating the behaviors to get that good feeling back again. So, but it comes becomes a disorder when it gets in the way too much and there's no alteration of it according to what's in the environment at that moment. So the sad mood persists in spite of things being safe, things being okay, in spite of getting all your needs met. That's depression.
I was going to say, so depression's a mood disorder.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I do want to disagree with that partially, and that Good. Is to say that so we have a diagnosis, and not to say that our diagnostic labels are sacrosanct, but we have a diagnosis called dysthymic disorder, which I think of as minor league depression. Mm-hmm. And more specifically, it's a depressed mood that persists, which does not interfere with functioning, but which prevents us from enjoying life and may be a reason to seek treatment. And in fact, I would say that in many communities, people who are functioning reasonably well, you know, they get out of bed in the morning, they put the kids on the bus or they cook breakfast or they go off to work and perform their job satisfactorily, but who really feel almost as if somebody took some of the air out of their tires.
That is a I saw you just sigh, you know. Yeah. The person with that there seems to be a right. when they tune in to how they're actually feeling, it's a low level blah, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. And when you are functioning adequately but you're not feeling good about life, it can also be confusing because you don't have any of the more profound, obvious clinical signs that would cause people around you to say, what's wrong with you? Right. And a lot of the people that we see in our offices who come for counseling or perhaps they're requesting medicine or whatever would fit this description.
Absolutely.
It's
an excellent point. I'm talking about the more extreme, but that's an absolutely excellent point.
Essentially, blah, blah, this is sort of a little bit off topic, but, you know, everybody's, you know, seeking for that happy life, right? You know, we grew up with this once upon a time and they lived happily ever after. And I can remember I was in my 20s and this guy that I said, you know, there's no such thing, right? There's no such thing as a happy life. I go, what do you mean? He said, there are happy moments. There is no happy life. And it was like a slap in the face. I was like, oh my God, he's right, right?
Sure. No, he's wrong. No, honestly, I would say that he was wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly this is a fellow who needs, you know, profound psychotherapy. because for a lot of other people, life is predominantly happy. Mm-hmm. And then there are moments that are not happy, are challenging, that are anxiety provoking, that are depressing. Certainly one of the sad realizations as you grow up is that you realize that there are going to be losses in life. Mm-hmm. There are going to be disappointments, that you're not always going to get what you want. This is one of the painful parts of growing up. Right. But that isn't to say that at the best you can hope for is the occasional happy moment.
Yeah, no, I don't. I think he was saying you can't be happy all the time. It isn't happiness,
right?
You know,
24/7. Sure.
Sometimes when people ask me in the office, you know, what is it can I expect from this treatment, whether it's medicine or whatever it is? I said, well, what we're aiming for here is that when you wake up in the morning, you're looking forward to your day. That, you know, putting on your clothing and brushing your teeth and getting on with your day, it feels like a good thing. It feels positive. Not that you wish that you could stay in bed and not put on your clothes. And so that's
dreading your life.
You have a positive feeling
about that.
Yeah. Right, so, give us some examples. We mentioned depression. What are some mood disorders?
Well, certainly depression is the most common, the other mood disorders are moods that change rapidly or can change from depression or go into depression and then become excessively active. We call that manic depression or mania being the upside of it. If somebody has characteristics of a mania or have had, then we call that type 1 bipolar disorder. Type 1 opposed to type 2. Type 2 bipolar disorder is also people who have had relatively mild manias, not so disruptive, certainly not psychotic, still periods of being hypertalkative, hyperactive, happy, a little bit euphoric, but they're not feeling that they're Jesus Christ saving the world. And enhanced productivity, rapid speech maybe, and maybe not so much sleep. That would be what we call a hypomania, somewhat slightly less than manic. And then they can circle into either right after that period of hypomania, they can go right into depression, or they can kind of be relatively normal for months on end. Maybe months later, they can dip into a depression that can last short time or frequently a long time, and it can be pretty debilitating. But it's up and down in a mild range. And then finally, there's a third condition called cyclothymia, which is people who shift pretty rapidly from in this between mild mania and mild depression. But they just that's their lifestyle, and it's not abnormal for them, so to speak. It's their baseline. And they can, you know, become more impaired at times, but not necessarily. Those would be the formal mood, or the other term is affective disorders, that we talk about. You can maybe even say anxiety is a mood disorder too, because some people are constantly anxious and worried. Put that into the basket of anxiety disorders rather than mood disorders.
Yeah. I'd like to maybe also add some historical perspective to this. So it's important for people to realize that, as much as you might wish it to be otherwise, medicine also is a constantly evolving field, and that the rules of today will not be the rules tomorrow, just as the rules of today are very different than they were even 20 or 30 years ago. So, for example, in the 1970s and 80s, it was actually really uncommon to give anybody a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, and the diagnosis of schizophrenia was being given much more often than the diagnosis of bipolar. Well, that has shifted profoundly in the last 30 years. 30 years isn't a long period of time. The DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the cookbook of mental health trades, is now in its fifth volume, and I'm sure it will go on to have many, many more. And I'd like to point out to people, for example, that homosexuality was diagnosed as a DSM disorder not that long ago. So things change. And so I'm here today to tell you what it's going to look like in another 10 or 15 or 20 years. I think we don't really know in a laboratory provable way where one diagnosis in mental health ends and another one begins. We don't have the radiographic techniques or the blood tests that so many other, specialties of medicine have. So we sort of fumble our way along, and I don't mean in any way to be disrespectful to the people who create the DSM, but it's the most recent decent pass at creating models.
It's complicated.
It's very complicated. And what I believe is in the process of happening is that the diagnosis of bipolar 1 and bipolar 2 are probably sort of disappearing, and what we're going to end up with, in my opinion, is what I'll call mood spectrum disorder, where a person falls somewhere along a very long spectrum from what's now called unipolar depression, which is what most of us think of as having a profound major depressive disorder, all the way to what Mark was describing, which is bipolar 1, in the same way that autism and Asperger's only in this most recent, you know, incarnation of the DSM have now become part of what's called autism spectrum disorder.
Right.
And so you can fall anywhere along that spectrum.
Right.
And I think we're going to see that happen for mood disorders too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going back to that, that's a little bit of the controversy over bipolar disorder. It's, and you're mentioning it being diagnosed a lot more today. And my question is, though, about what age you would say, because we're seeing young children being diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which I don't know.
Well, when I worked in the schools in South Carolina, I worked for a program that had mental health counselors in all the elementary schools and psychiatrists who would see the children referred. And I have to say that bipolar was just being the hot new diagnosis for children. And I think it was over-applied.
Yeah.
And the child that was hyperactive was confused because of their activity level. The child that was in an abusive, highly abusive situation and would come to school angry and unable to contain that, that was the diagnosis was often called bipolar disorder for children. So I think it was the diagnosis of the day for children, and hopefully we've moved away from that. But in terms of seeing bipolar disorder, I think it really comes to fore around generally age 26 or so. But they say if a child has been in an abusive home, the symptoms can be seen much earlier.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, Jonathan?
Well, I think bipolar disorder is often misdiagnosed today at every age. There's no age that is safe from being, you know, unfortunately misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder. In children, it's very easy to confuse a bipolar disorder and ADHD. And there's no rule, by the way, that says you can't have both. And I've had plenty of patients who do have both. And one way you can uncover this, and I certainly agree that, you know, it's very tricky to give that label to a child, and one really wants to, if you can, you know, follow things over time and see how things unfold before you start throwing, you know, medicine at children. But at the same time, we know that there are children who really can't be tolerated in the classroom because of aggressive behavior and so on. I made the mistake myself several times early in my career of diagnosing a child with ADHD, starting them on stimulant medicine, only to see them get much worse. When a person, whether adult or child, has ADHD and bipolar disorder, and you place them on a stimulant before the mood swings have been approached, things get much worse. Mm. And that's one way you know that you're on the wrong track. People, I see this in the clinic where I work, which treats addicts. People who are in recovery first are often misdiagnosed, in my opinion, with bipolar disorder during the first 6 to 12 months after stopping their use of drugs, because your brain chemistry is all scrambled up and you're up and you're down and you're feeling great about not using, and then you're depressed because you're not seeing your children and your life is a wreck. I see this all the time, people being discharged from detox facilities and rehab facilities with a diagnosis of bipolar. If people would just wait and try to just treat symptoms as needed and give the person's brain a chance to settle down for 6 to 12 months, what you often see is that, no, this that really is not. Sure. It's completely invalid.
So. Yeah, I think we have to face a probably an ugly phenomenon in our profession. And sometimes the availability of treatment dictates diagnosis. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you have a treatment that can be applied to a group of symptoms that you see, you're more likely to say, oh, that's the disorder. Right. Therefore, we give the medication. I'm talking about primarily medication here, or biological treatments. So that exists. And I think that was one of the drivers of the overdiagnosis of bipolar in kids. And if you take that phenomenon to the extreme, then you have the kind of paranoid position that American pharmaceutical companies are behind all this and pushing their medicines for profit, just like they pushed the opioids for profit. And look where we are. So we have to be at least aware of that phenomenon. Not that we can't do something positive when we're presented with a kid, say, who can't fit into the class.
Our number. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it, you know, it's useful for people listening to know that there is a certain pressure driven by the insurance companies, driven by the healthcare system, to assign diagnoses perhaps too quickly for billing purposes, for all kinds of purposes. In many places that use an electronic medical record, a person doesn't even exist without a diagnosis. I mean, you know, like you can't create a file without giving
without
somebody
a diagnosis. Yeah.
And so, but it's not always easy to assign somebody a diagnosis quickly. And I think one of the things I found is that patients, I often will say to a person toward the end of a first visit, I say, you know, I'd really, if you don't mind coming back, I'd really like to have another long visit with you because, you know, I think your history is complex and really I have so many more questions to ask. I've never had anybody say, I'm not coming back. Are you kidding? You've already had an hour. No, actually, people really appreciate that. They respond very positively to that. But in a lot of settings, a lot of clinic settings and so on, it's that's not what happens.
Yeah.
You know,
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about mood disorders this morning with social worker Anne Gagan and psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz and Mark Whaley. So let's talk about, before we get to some treatment, symptoms. You know, we're talking about this is kind of tough to diagnose, but and there's this whole spectrum we could be on. So what are some of the symptoms that would indicate we had a mood disorder or somebody did?
Well, the symptoms, you can, I think the layman can kind of put together a list that will pretty come close to what we consider as valid symptoms. But the concept is that whatever, quote, thing we're calling a symptom, it's prolonged. It's not just a momentary or a reaction to a situation, a bad day. We're not talking about bad days here. And actually, in one of the criterias for major depression, the symptom has to be there for a couple of weeks, I think, is the cutoff. But basically, for depression, we're talking about prolonged sadness, unexplained crying spells, significant changes in appetite and sleep patterns, irritability, anger, worry, agitation, and anxiety. That's part of it. So when somebody is anxious, it could be part of a mood disorder as opposed to just an anxiety disorder. Also, a chronic view of pessimism and indifference to the world, loss of energy, persistent lethargy, feelings of guilt and worthlessness, inability to concentrate. Also, indecisiveness is one of the features. People go into a supermarket, they can't decide what to get. It just is overwhelming. And certainly inability to take pleasure in former interests. People that are depressed are generally withdrawn socially. They can also have unexplained aches and pains. And they frequently will go to their primary care doctor around this. And then finally, the fatal part, or potentially fatal part of depression, is persistent thoughts of death or suicide, ending this misery. So depression can be a fatal disorder. Unfortunately, frequently is.
Yeah.
You mentioned aches and pains, and I just want to take the opportunity to point out that pain, particularly chronic pain, is a very common cause of depression, particularly in older people.
Sure.
And it's really underappreciated by spouses and family members that when somebody has spinal stenosis or they have chronic lower back pain, pain from arthritic joints, and, you know, whatever the cause might be, I mean, it is depressing to be in pain for a long period of time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And even though in this situation, as is true in many other situations, there's an identifiable cause for the depression, that does not mean it does not deserve treatment. Mm-hmm. Because we know that people who are depressed, even for good reasons, respond to treatment just as well as people who don't have a good reason to be depressed.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, actually, the brain circuits that govern pain perception overlap significantly with mood regulation. And a lot of pain, a lot of treatments for chronic pain turn out to be antidepressants, so taking advantage of that overlap.
Yeah. So there's lots of treatment options, right? And this can be, can be overwhelming, right? When you come in, you say, okay, what, you know, how do I want to treat this? So you guys, tell me, what do you do when somebody comes in and you've determined what mood disorder they're, what are the options?
Well, I'll start. I think certainly the algorithm that I use in thinking about treatment really starts with a judgment on my part of the degree of severity. Mm-hmm. So if somebody, let's say, has dysthymic disorder, which we talked about, you know, they're functioning, but they're unhappy. They can get up and do what they have to do, but there's not really joy for them in their life. I certainly, my first recommendation for such a person would be some form of counseling, whether that's a cognitive behavioral therapy or a therapy that's focused on identifying what's going on in their life that might be that kind of chronic thorn in their side. Their job makes them miserable, you know, whatever it is, and to look for things that they can do to change their circumstances and get back on a track of feeling well. If the depression is more substantial and interfering in their functioning, then you think about medication. And that can range, in my practice, kind of one of the more common antidepressant medications, or if somebody is profoundly disabled by their depression. So, for example, a college student who's in their room, not going to classes, not going to the dining hall, at best maybe playing video games, and maybe their roommate or somebody down the hall has come to the counseling center and reported, hey, you guys might want to do something because this guy hasn't left his room in 2 weeks. Or a person who's not going to work, an older person who's not going to work because they're too depressed, they just want to pull the covers over their heads. I will actually start a person on a combination of two medications at the same time right off the bat, because that's my best chance of getting them functioning most quickly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that would be in combination with counseling most of the time. There are situations where a person really isn't able to benefit from counseling because they're so profoundly depressed that you're just going through the motions to wheel them into a room and have them sit with somebody. But certainly when they're able to benefit from an interactive relationship and be able to participate in it, some form of counseling, whether it's a cognitive behavioral therapy or some other form of psychotherapy, it should be.
And there are times when you've had somebody who's had severe depression who isn't responding to medication, and I can't remember what it's called.
TMS?
Tell us about that.
Well, above and beyond the treatments that we've had available for a long time, there's a number of maybe more novel treatments. TMS, which I've been on the air here talking about before, transcranial magnetic stimulation, has been now approved by the FDA for 11 years and is available, in New Bedford and soon in other areas, but certainly in Boston and around. There have been over 2 million TMS treatments given in this country. So this is not a brand new treatment. And for people who have failed on a variety of medication trials, this is now being paid for by all the commercial insurance companies, unfortunately not by any of the state mm-hmm. plans in Massachusetts. Hopefully that will come soon. They're also and the batting average of TMS is very high. It's 70% or 80%. I mean, we can get into the details if you want to, but there also are ketamine should be mentioned. Esketamine treatment was just approved about 1 month ago by the FDA, and that will be available soon in clinics and centers around the country. Docs are in the process of setting up clinics. Ketamine. It's a bit controversial, I suppose, in a way. And again, it's probably something that insurance companies, when they do decide to go ahead and pay for it, will probably only agree to pay for it in people who have failed on multiple medication trials.
Go back to the TMS for a second, because you did 70% to 80%. That's a pretty high figure.
It is. It's amazing.
And especially for people who have had such not success in so many other things. So for people who didn't hear you talk about TMS last time we talked about this, just kind of summarize what the treatment is.
So this uses a magnetic pulses. Actually, the technology was invented by the same people who invented the MRI for General Electric 30, 40 years ago. whenever that was. And it uses a very gentle magnetic pulses. The coil is actually just placed on the top of your head in the sort of sweet spot of your left-sided cortex. And the treatments typically last about 18 minutes. The whole treatment is 36 treatments, and there are zero side effects. And so you're right. It's remarkable that between 70 and 80% of people have either a complete remission of their depression or at least a 50% improvement.
That's amazing.
It is. I mean, it took me a long time to sort of buy into the literally and figuratively buy into the technology and actually, place a machine in my office in New Bedford. And I'm just continue to be amazed. I just interviewed a woman, 2 weeks ago who's been receiving treatment from a good psychiatrist at Mass General for 20 years, has been, just really disabled by her depression. And she's almost good as new.
Wow.
It's incredible to see.
Yeah. We've not known exactly how antidepressants work, exactly what makes them there. But one thing that TMS has in common with medication and with electroshock therapy, which was the old sort of stimulate the brain intervention, and still is available and useful. One thing they all have in common is they disrupt the brain temporarily. Psychedelics also. Mm-hmm. That's becoming psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy is coming to the fore. They basically have the characteristic of disrupting something in the brain temporarily, and it's like a reset or a reboot kind of clears the detritus or whatever to reset. Because depression is much more than just a psychological or emotional state. It really is a body state. And there are changes in hormone levels. There's changes in brain circuitry. Some parts of the brain are more active than they should be, and other parts are underactive. So it's a profound total body experience. That's why we want to use as much as we can to intervene. That's why we use some biological treatments plus the psychological treatments. The psychological treatments, by the way, when they're successful, have been shown to change the brain in the same way pretty much that the medication does when it's successful.
Yeah.
And it should be said that, people are afraid to death of ECT because it is scary and because everybody's seen Jack Nicholson in the movies, and it is scary and it does involve anesthesia. And it's certainly the most aggressive, the most intrusive of the biological treatments that we have.
But deep brain stability. Yeah. But
people need to know that it is by far the most effective, in terms of batting average, mm-hmm. by far the most effective treatment for depression for people who have a severe, stubborn depression.
Kitty Dukakis.
Yeah.
Read Kitty's book. Yeah.
Sure.
She swears
by it. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Is ketamine addictive?
No. No,
apparently not. Although I think the verdict is not in yet, mm-hmm. But as it becomes more used, we'll get the verdict.
Yeah, this is new, right?
Yeah, this is new. Well, ketamine is an old drug that's an anesthetic and is still used by anesthesia specialists all the time for surgery purposes. But the use of it in psychiatry, yes, is new. One of the, we haven't had really new antidepressants in terms of new mechanisms for 30 years or so. We're working with the old molecules. Now they're old. They had been new. So there's big search race really to get an effective medication that works on a different mechanism, and the mechanisms that have been pinpointed are ketamine works on one of them. It's called the glutamate mechanism. We don't know if ketamine exerts its antidepressant effect through glutamate, but at least that's the purported mechanism. The other is the opioid mechanism. There's drugs trying to work with the reward system, which is what the opioid system is chemically, because depression is an assault on reward. You don't get any pleasure in things. So right. you know that that system is amiss. So there are medications being developed that might stimulate the opioid system without having the addiction baggage associated. Ketamine doesn't work on the opioid system, and so it's probably safe to say that it's not addictive.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about mood disorders with Ann Gagan, social worker and psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation or you have a question for us. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So treatment for bipolar, is it the same, similar to what we're talking about here for other mood disorders?
It's similar. However, if somebody does have a bipolar disorder, in other words, they've had a history of mania, and they present in the office, which is very, very common, with depression. You don't want to give them an antidepressant to begin with, even though what you're seeing is depression, because an antidepressant by itself can precipitate a manic episode. And then after that, there's a lot of difficulty in treating and getting somebody back to the baseline if you've precipitated a mania. So the basic thing that we try to do is use medications that are mood stabilizers. The probably the best known one is lithium, and maybe even in some ways the most effective is lithium. Lithium just kind of quiets nerve cells. The other kinds of mood stabilizers that exist are anti-seizure medications, who would do the same thing, same mechanism, by various chemical pathways. Stabilize overactive nerves. So that's what the advantage of a mood stabilizer. Then the third group that we have are all the what's called the second generation antipsychotics. These are antipsychotic drugs that can work in schizophrenia for the most part, but have some mood stabilizing properties because of their chemical profile. Frequently they're used. And all these things are used in combination. So it's not uncommon for somebody with bipolar disorder to have a list of six or seven medications that they're taking. They all get added sequentially to hopefully control a symptom that's not being controlled, but then or prevent, because the aim in bipolar disorder is to prevent mood episodes. Treat the active one that's there now and prevent the recurrence, because the more recurrences you have, the more recurrences you're going to have, and the more severe they're going to be, the more disabling they're going to be. And this is what's so hard to get across to the patient, because, first off, in terms of mania, it feels great.
Don't want to stop.
And people around them can be drawn to them and get real excited. They're the life of the party. In terms of their brain health over the course of their life, they're doing damage to it. It's very hard for somebody to accept taking a preventive medicine like lithium or one of the antipsychotic drugs to prevent the cycling of moods. Eventually people do. They learn. They learn the hard way. They have to do it that way. So in terms of treatment, we're talking about treating the episode at hand and preventing the future.
Here's another little pointer for people who are listening to the show. Doctors in general find it much easier to add medicines than they do to subtract them.
Absolutely.
And one of the reasons that people, whether you're talking about your cardiac medicines or your psychiatric medicines, one of the reasons that people end up on 7 or 8 or 10 different medicines is precisely for the reason that I just said, that it's just easier to add medicines than it is to take them away. We do have this group of medicines that Mark just referred to, the second-generation antipsychotics, unfortunately called antipsychotics, but I think that they are actually in the process of becoming first-line treatment for bipolar disorder for the simple reason that they not only act as mood stabilizers and very, you know, strong, very robust mood stabilizers, but also as antidepressants.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So medicines that are quite new, my favorite being Rexulti, Abilify, Latuda, Geodone are examples. Vraylar are the newest of these medicines. Those are medicines that you can give to somebody who comes in who's depressed, who you think might have bipolar disorder, but you're not sure. You don't really want to put them on an antidepressant because you don't want to send them to the moon, as Mark said. But these are medicines that have, you know, pretty good in some cases excellent antidepressant properties. And are also mood stabilizers. So you can treat their depression without putting them at risk for a manic episode. And in the past 6 months, I've had several patients, you know, text me or call me within 48 hours of being started on one of these medicines saying, "You're a genius. I feel great. This is awesome."
And then you agree.
But it's true. I don't work or receive any payment, unfortunately, from any drug company. But Rexulti has really turned out to be the best medicine I've seen since Prozac came out 30 years ago.
Well, this is such good news. I mean, that there, you know, I think in, there's a general stereotype that with bipolar disorder, it's nothing but a constant search for the right medication and the right mixture. And then people don't like the effects of the medications. They make them feel dull and gain weight and so forth. So this is really good news to hear. And we should continue to make sure that's out there.
Interesting to note also that in Canada, there's a movement afoot to insist on renaming classes of medicines. So, for example, instead of calling these medicines atypical antipsychotics, which is an unfortunate, it's an understandable historic, there is an explanation for why they are called that. But there are a lot of things. And I try to explain to a patient, I'm giving you this medicine. You're going to go home. You're going to look it up on the internet. You're going to see that it's used for schizophrenia and it's called an atypical antipsychotic. You're not psychotic. I don't believe you have schizophrenia. Here's why I'm giving it to you. Mm-hmm. So in Canada, there is this, you know, very sort of intelligent thoughtfulness about, you know, maybe medicines should be labeled according to their mechanism of action and not according to some FDA historic kind of, you know.
Because that's how we prescribe them. We prescribe them according to the mechanism of action that we understand.
Yeah. Let's talk to Bill, who's giving us a call from somewhere on Cape Cod. Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
Good. Do you have a question or a comment for us? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I do. We're talking about mental health, correct?
Yes.
I'm an older person, and I've been going through a lot of stages of stuff. I'm afraid to even go to somebody because I'm not too sure where to even start.
Bill, you know what? You're reading our mind here, because this is the next question is, what do you look for when you're seeking treatment, and how do you do that? So, Bill, I'm going to get right to the docs and let them answer that question.
It's so hard to know where to turn, and I see this in people's eyes even when they come to my office, just overwhelmed by a whole bunch of symptoms and not knowing even how to evaluate is what I'm about to hear, you know, accurate? Is it gonna help me? It's also complicated, of course, because of so much is dictated again by what kind of insurance you have in your insurance plan. So if you're an older person, for example, over the age of 65, and you have Medicare, in some ways you're in a good place because you don't have to get prior authorization and you don't have to worry about a referral network. You will face a certain amount of discrimination, perhaps, because some doctors, some psychiatrists may be limiting the number of Medicare patients they have only because Medicare, in fact, pays quite poorly compared to other insurances. I want to sort of broaden it, though, just to talk in general about what people can do when they want to seek help and they're just not quite sure where to turn. You can start with your going online to your insurance network and look at the list of people. You can ask your primary care doctor, who often will know of somebody to refer you to. I think what's really most important, though, is that you be a discriminating consumer of mental health services. Too many people will go to see a therapist, a counselor, a psychiatrist, a nurse practitioner, and continue with that person even though they're really feeling dissatisfied with what they're receiving. They don't feel that the chemistry – finding somebody to talk to, finding somebody to talk about your anxiety or depression, whatever, it's a lot like dating. You know, it's chemistry. You have to find somebody that you feel, you know, gets who you are, is listening to you, is empathic, and who you feel comfortable talking to. And unfortunately, you know, those aren't always easy to find, but you have to be willing to keep looking because you will find somebody. Just as like, you know, like they say in the car business, there's an ask for every seat. If you look long enough, you know, you will find somebody that you do feel that chemistry with. And I remember when I was a resident in psychiatry and it was suggested to me that perhaps I would benefit from some therapy. It took me a few therapists to find somebody, and I knew very quickly this person is such a precious, asset for me.
All right. Anybody else want to add to that?
I would echo it, certainly. Mm-hmm. The only characteristic I would add to what you just said would be who's accepting non-judgmentally of what you're presenting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I think the common experience in starting to seek mental health treatment is shame. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps people away from the office a lot. But if they do overcome that enough to get in the door, it's still a big, big burden on them.
And what about the wait list? Because, I mean, especially in the Cape, it's tough. I mean, you want to see somebody now, and you're probably not going to get in now.
You have to accept that our health system, especially in mental health, is terribly broken. You have to approach it with that. So therefore, think of yourself as Dunkirk after the bombing, that you have to scrap, you have to search around for something to find that's going to be give you something to survive.
Well, I think this is where the family comes in too, because when you think of the onset of, perhaps bipolar disorder, 26, 27, usually it's the person's out in the world, but the people around them are saying there's something really wrong here. And oftentimes that individual may come back to the family of origin. Maybe the parents or the partner are really the ones that are, you know, insisting that they get help. So I think one approach to this that we have to psychoeducation of not only the patient, but of the family members address the shame, to address the behaviors that, again, with hypomanic, can be very exciting but also very disturbing.
Sure.
And so it really takes a team an understanding that this disease or this condition really affects the entire family, as all mental health disorders do. That's where NAMI is a wonderful resource for families who are dealing with people who have either depressive disorders or bipolar disorders. That's a place to get group support and to learn about how to advocate and how to ask the right questions and get the right doctor and the right medication.
And temper the shame, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's very good with that. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right, because it impacts the whole family, no matter what the mental health issue is, right?
Exactly.
And a lot of therapists and doctors will insist on seeing the whole family, right, depending on whatever the issue is. Right. And just like real quickly, of like 30 seconds, is that helpful when you have a patient and you can see the family dynamics and meet with the whole family?
Makes much more better treatment. I think you get much more information, and also you get some allies for positive change.
Mm-hmm. All right. Ann Gagan, social worker, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Thank you, as always. We'll see you
next month.
Very good.
Thank you. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.